Okay, so one last piece of Zohar. This one is less about Matan Torah and about Talmud Torah. We're doing this one now. I could have done it later when we do the Vilna Gaon, the Shla, Chassidut, and Mitnagdut. This is where Talmud Torah becomes combined with Revelation. So it's less the Zohar as a specific point, and much more what the passage of Eastern Europe puts at the core and center of their thinking on Torah and Revelation. Okay, this is from the New Danny Mack translation, the full big one. Can I get someone to read? Go.
I have put my words in your mouth. How vital it is for a human being to engage in Torah day and night. The Blessed One listens to the voice of those who occupy themselves in Torah. And every word innovated by Torah, in Torah, by one engaged in Torah, fashioned to one heaven.
Okay, so we now have the importance of learning Torah day and night. God listens to it, and we now have this new phrase, Chidushei Torah, which takes a much bigger role in the Zohar and then later Eastern European thought than there is in the Gemara. Like, you don't think the Gemara doesn't always talk about Chidushei Torah. It talks about Hilchata. It talks about a Chavaya, Chapter Vitaria, whatever, but Chidusha now takes on a great role that you please God. They talk about it in an exegetical way, but not in this abstract, intoned way that we now. I mean, you know the Ramban design, there is Chidusha, and so does the Ram, but here it now becomes intoned. Chidushei Torah, and you know, and at this point we know what that phrase means, because the very activity of the Beit Midrash was no longer Aliba de Hilchata, it was no longer mastery of text. It's now become derailed, and the project becomes a brand new project. Continue.
We have learned. The moment the new word of Torah illuminates from the mouth of the being, that word ascends and presents herself before the Blessed Holy One. Who lifts that word, kisses her, and adorns her with 70 crowns, and grave and his bride. But an innovating word of wisdom ascends and settles from the head of the stock of gracious one, the vitality of the worlds.
Mm-hmm.
From there it flies and soars through 70,000 worlds, ascending into the ancient shades. All the words of the ancient beings are words of wisdom.
Okay, skip now. There's endless mysteries in the Torah. We've seen this before. Turn to the next page. Well, this is 27 in the right hand margin. No, he replied.
The Torah was transmitted to Moses. Myriads of celestial angels came to scorch and explain from their mouths because of what the Holy One sheltered. Now when this word ascends, is allowed, is stands before the Blessed Holy One, it shelters that word and covers that person, so that it will not be discovered by that, aroused and rejoiced. Before that word is transformed into new heavens and a new earth, as it is written, I have covered you in the shadow of my hand, my friend and establisher.
Okay, there's now a sail that protects you. When you study, so the angels, your words have incredible effect up above. You affect olamot. Your words are rumo shalom, and God is taking care of it. Like I said, I could have done this with Chassidut and Mitnagdut, but while we are here, you know, with the Zohar, it's not directly Matan Torah, but it's going to be transferred that all discussions among Eastern European Achronim, whether the Gra or Rav Nachman, are going to be transferred to this passage. Okay, turn the page. And this is also very uniquely Eastern European. Now,
if you say that the word of any ignorant person had the same effect, come and see. One who is not accustomed to the mysteries of Torah and innovates words and does not fully understand them, but that would ascend a man of perversity, tongue of falsity, bursts forth from the chasm of the events of God has, leaving 500 parasangs to obtain that word. Dragging her, he takes that word back to his chasm and transmortifies her into distorted heaven called
Okay, but this is not for everybody. Eat Svarim, eat Svarim. There are books and there are books. If the ignorant person comes up with Chiddushei Torah, then woe to that mouth of perversity. Then we let all the evil forces grab the words, grab the person. That it's not just anybody who can have Chiddushei Torah, it's a righteous one, as opposed to the perverse ones.
This transmogrifying.
Basically Musa. I mean, he's using words that are almost onomatopoetic here for the Aramaic to convey that sense of these, you know, horrific science fiction that you're going to become an attack. But most of Eastern Europe has a very strong dualism. There are true tzaddikim and false tzaddikim. There's true Torah and there's false Torah. And that plays a role here as a control. I mean, we'll play a role in Eastern Europe within this Chiddushei Torah. Yes.
It seems like in the first half, the blessing of the Lord is so long that when you do the Chiddushei Torah, you have a revelation. It seems more like you're saying it to it. It seems more like God listens to you as opposed to you being able to hear.
Well, that's revelation also. The fact that one's reverence to one's Torah is already our distinction. They're not distinguishing in that way. Okay, so that's the control. So we saw it in the Ramban and the Ran. It doesn't have, you know, you're going to be snatched if you make a mistake, or woe to the ignorant one. You're really just not part of it. And then finally, turn to the last page. Simeon said to his companions,
I may have been bound to utter a word of Torah that you do not know and have not heard properly from a lawful tree. Thus you can sin to slay multitudes without cause.
Okay, so don't say any Torah that you don't have a Kabbalah for. It'll cause evil to come to the world. Continue.
This is against the mission.
Well, when that becomes the tension of the Zohar, it's pro-Chidushim. But woe to you if you don't have a tradition for your Chiddushim. And there's a level of the Zohar plays on a tension between new ancient words, renewing the ancient words through our own Chiddushim to get back to that primordial Torah. But rather where the Ramban it remains in heaven, here it's our innovations have truly got to be getting back to where we once belonged, to the ancient point, rather than leaving the world. And there is that tension, like, we don't say anything about a Kabbalah, but everything has to be Chiddushei Torah. We've left ourselves in a point that's the Rishonim don't pick up on, but the Eastern Europeans will love this tension. Continue.
They all have been saying, they have compassion on the city, they have compassion on the city. Come and see, toward the blessed Lord who created the world. This has been established as a dream. I was with him as a nursling. I was created with the light. Gave to ponder once, twice, three, four times, and spoke, creating through her. Teach human beings not to err. The blessed one who created what he created corresponds to those four times. He saw and declared her, arranged her, and probed her. Before generating his work, he introduced four worlds, creation, bara, elokim, and first these four, ben ha-shamayim, the heavens. These correspond to the four kinds of blessed whole and contemplated Torah before actualizing his work of art.
Okay. Questions? Now, this is Zohar. The Tikkuni Zohar introduces a distinction between Torah HaBriah and Torah HaTzilut, and says there's a higher revelation of Torah HaTzilut. Now, whatever that distinction corresponds to, Halakha and Kabbalah, or knowledge that's in the books versus experiential knowledge, Chaim Vital, in his introduction to the Shvona Sharim, also reprinted in the introduction to the Eitz Chaim, explains the Arei, the Isaac Luria, the Arizal, as teaching Torah Atzilut. Therefore, he can't be questioned by reason, because he knows Atzilut, and you, O mortals, quoting me the Talmud Bavli of the Halacha, are only Torah Bria. There is an undercurrent of a sort of Abulafia language that somebody worthy can have true prophecy today, and that transcends rational knowledge. Now, to put the upshot of that, is that if you had just read the Chaim Vital introduction, therefore Tzaddikim and Lurianic Kabbalah is greater than Halacha, and many figures, whether the Ramah Mafana, the Ben Yishchai, many Tzaddikim, held the Arizal has to therefore be followed because he is a higher prophecy. Chabad will claim for its own minhagim that it's its own new prophecy. Figures like the Vilna Gaon would say no, even if you have prophecy, it can't override the Bavli. Once the Bavli is there, the Gaon, Chassam Sofer, hold that position. I'm leaving it before we get to Eastern Europe, because this gives us the other pole of the tension between, is there a prophetic Torah still with us today, or does everything have to be in the books? So our first tension from the Zohar is between Chidushei Torah and Kabbalah. The second tension is between even Chidushei Torah and all book knowledge versus charismatic and prophetic authority. Everyone's got those two tensions. We are going to pause with this and come back to it after we do the biblical criticism, because then we have our glide as whether you want more Gro or Nachman or Tzadok or Isbitz. Then we glide for the remainder of the course doing the Eastern European material, which is all dealing with these four poles of attention: Kabbalah and Chidushei Torah, prophecy versus text, and you'll see how each one renders these things different. I also put it now so you can have some sense of closure on the Zohar in your mind of what the potential of the text is before we see some incredibly innovative restorations of what the Zohar meant. Okay.
But,
yes.
Now, Shabbos, we were talking about, like in Hikkabos, it says, speak to Rei Torah at the table.
Right.
We were discussing what's important. This is basically what does the Rei Torah mean, right?
Right.
Is this? Like, is the Rei Torah, does it have to be in the book, or does it still be? Is a
prophetic Torah. Right. So therefore, if you are the Vilna Gaon and you're pushing me ahead, and therefore must refer to books, yeah, and if it's coming from the soul, then it's demonic and probably Shadim arresting on you. While if you're a follower of Rav Nachman, no, those could be the deepest words that come from even beyond the text. To put it in the most extremes. And that becomes a very rich discussion. But at least we have the basics. But now we have to do Alvo. Okay, Rav Yosef Alvo, another basic building block. We have the Sefer Ikarim, beginning of the 15th century. Much of it is a harvest from whether they're not just the Ron, but Tzemach Duran, Kreskes, and many other late 14th, early 15th century thinkers. There will be a shift in Alba from Maimonidean and Nachmanidean emphasis on prophecy and metaphysics to concern with the human, the ethical. So rather than having Maimonides and discussions of metaphysics, Alba will use Aristotle's ethics. What is the purpose of life? Rather than Nachmanides' Kabbalah, we now have the importance of things. Kabbalah gives status to things within our daily life. Albo is also a path for the, here is the basic, what you believe, what are the basic pillars of Judaism. For Albo, there are three basics of Judaism: belief in God, belief in Torah, Revelation, and belief in Sechar V'Onesh. They are open to a broad range of interpretation. So Albo will synthesize in the simplest form both Maimonides and Nachmanides. In a broader form, he will synthesize Sadia, Yehuda Levi, Rambam, Ramban, Rashi, Zohar, Jigatila, through the eyes of Kreskes and Sanakhtiran and others. Albo holds, you know, if you are mistaken in one of these, if you were intending to serve God and to seek the truth, you are not a heretic. A heretic is someone who denies the principles, not someone who makes a mistake in understanding. And for most purposes, Albo becomes the bottom line. You know, universally, you have to believe in the Gemalei Karim or Torah or the fact that Judaism does have dogma and beliefs. This is really the basic line, you know, giving you that synopsis, this range of, you know, letting it be that, you know, Rambam and Ramban in most cases are open, you know, giving you that sort of Rishonic range of what to believe in. Okay? His discussion, this entire volume 3 is on Torah Ben HaShemayim, but his discussion of it is very broad and loose. So hold off on questions for a minute to understand, to see how broad he actually is. Meaning, the book chapter 1 deals with, we know that God exists, but human life has to have a purpose. We know that animals have a purpose. He talks about Perek Shira, the purpose of all the animals, and where everything fits into creation, and everything has a goal. What is man's purpose? Chapters 3, 4, and 5. It can't be perfection of knowledge or prophecy, meaning the elitism of the 13th century can't be correct, because then, you know, only one in a thousand are perfect intellects, like Plato or Socrates. We are not all on that level of Plato and Socrates.
Those are his examples.
Because they still held, you know, the ancients still were seen as the wisest people. You know what?
He wasn't going to call like a fire or
anything. No, no. That's our much more conservative term that we don't recognize Chachma Bagayim anymore. But they were Rishonim, they did. And there was Chachma Bagayim. And clearly there was an unequivocal understanding that Plato was one of the greats of all times of humanity. But the fact is most people are not there. So that can't be the purpose of life. Chapters 4 and 5, he talks about various limits of knowledge. There are whole fields in which we can't really know what's going on. Well, I'm not going. He deals with technical medieval astronomy and meteorology and things. They're not our current fields. Then he says, so therefore he concludes chapters 5, 6, 7. Our purpose of life must be to know God, follow God's rules, be the best we can, and through following the words of the prophets. So prophecy and revelation has now become an instruction manual for life. He is the one who introduces that language of the instruction manual, teaching us how to best fulfill Aristotle's ethics. And chapter 8 is one of the definitional chapters, and I'm reading in here. And the reason I didn't photocopy this is because you've ever used the English translation of Albo. They did it on these little teeny half-size pages, which are impossible to unyielded, that really should be reissued in full size. You know what? I'd actually email JPS that. Because I actually emailed contact with them about reviewing books for them, which I do regularly. Maybe I really should tell them to. Because this is like the most unyielding 5-volume set, you know, index card size. It doesn't even stay open. To put out one normal volume of Alvo in English. Chapter 8 starts. The divine inspiration, which he said was necessary in order that we may know through it what things are acceptable to God and what things are not, man cannot acquire by himself. Okay, so you want to know about listening to God, what to do. You can't do it yourself without divine consent. For it is not natural that the spirit of an intellect devoid of matter should rest upon a material thing. For this reason, all the ancients thought it impossible that the divine spirit should rest on man, and the latter should prophesy by means of supernatural power. And therefore, the ancients used to make images and burn incense and offer prayers to the stars to bring down the spiritual influence of some star upon the images. And that's why they did divination. And the final answer that he then gives is, we as followers of Torah know you don't need the imagery and the incense, just purifying yourself morally, spiritually, and intellectually is enough. We don't need the imagery and the incense. From the way he tells it over, and even though the footnote here is to the Ramban discussion of the ancient fortune tellers, you hear an echo of an anti-Christian polemic in here. We don't need imagery and incense, because he doesn't say we don't need sacrifices. He says we don't need incense. And that certainly would be the image of the Catholic Church that he's rejecting. But we just, through ethical, moral, religious perfection, can attain prophecy. Let me continue. He says prophecy comes to the prophets, and each one has their own, even though it's from God, each one has their own style, because it's like a mirror reflecting from up above. It's a reflective process. We shine and we become filled with the divine word. So rather than the Maimonidean self-perfection, in which there's the human element within the perfection itself, here we have, or rather than the Nachmanidean through a glass darkly of that fiery Torah, here we have, we can become vessels to receive this supernatural illumination. The technical terms is that Maimonides would be an acquisition, a kinyan in philosophic terms, an abstraction in modern terms. You acquire knowledge through prophecy. For Albo, it is illumination. It comes down and takes over your mind. You become illuminated, and it's not that you sit there and figure it out. You acquire this great knowledge, the nefach, the yishacher. Now you become shining. The prophetic words start shining through you. Yes, yes. That was chapter 11, 12. Chapter 13, 14, 15 are beyond this course, but they're good reading, especially as we go into the section on biblical criticism. They deal with the Maimonidean approach, who are adamant that the Torah and the law never changes. Sadi and Maimonides were clearly trying to refute the Muslims who said that the law changed. Albo surprises us and says, you know what, I don't think that the law doesn't change is really one of the Ikarim. And in fact, these chapters are a certain gold mine of material showing, of course, the Shaksav Ashuris was not the ancient Hebrew script. And he cites that letter of Nachmanides when he saw ancient Hebrew script coins, and then he realized there had to have been a change. I mean, Albo cites all the cases where he, as a 14th century figure, knows that Chazal are not the same as the Bible or Bayecheni. And then he knows that various different forms and different ways of keeping the Torah occurred. Like I said, a great discussion for the history of change in Torah. Chapters 13, 14, 15, and then he comes back to it again later, because he builds with this. He even talks and he uses the word of Torah, that Adam had one Torah, Noah had a different Torah, Moshe was given a different Torah. So we see there can be changes. Well, he makes actually more. He quotes all the Gemara's we've shown him dealing with that originally, you know, Adam was a vegetarian, and then Torah Moshe allows the eating of meat. So it's not even stricter or stringent. Different times, different calls of Torah were needed at different times. These pieces of Alba, which really take us very far afield, are quoted both in early Hasidism and quoted by early as a Berkowitz dealing with Lo Vashemayim, meaning these Albas have a long history completely separate than Revelation. So I'm taking the moment to point them out. Know that they're here. Know when you see them cited in later books to come back and deal with them. Because they're fascinating how much room Albo gives. Albo gives room for, that's why Chazal needed Tachanot. That's why we had Karbanot or Batel, because obviously we don't keep Karbanot anymore. He just gives loads of these cases showing there is some non-continuity going on. Drawing none of the big modern questions, but giving you lots of food for thought. In chapter 18, he comes back and says, so what was Torah? And he writes, it is clear that they received from prophecy, prophetic inspiration, face to face, the first two commandments, meaning everyone at Har Sinai heard the first two commandments, peh el peh. The first commandment teaches that God provides for us and guides us. This is the meaning of the expression, thy God, the one who guides thee. The commandment ends with the words, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt. I am the one who took care of thee and took thee out of bondage, points to providence. Okay, so like the Drashot Haran, Albo points out how Revelation was God's existence and his providential care to Am Yisrael, and the fact that he's involved with Am Yisrael, that they heard.
Why is that in the second commandment?
Because I took you out from Egypt. It's in the first commandment. I mean, I'm involved in your life. So it's an ethical, moral imperative. Not the same, exactly the same as our historic approach of the moderns, because this is less historically oriented and much more reward, punishment, and meaning in life oriented. This is more psychologically oriented. So if we wanted to create another modern argument, I could easily turn Albo either into, you were taken out from Egypt, therefore, like Berkowitz said, I'm concerned with you forever, and that was the message of Revelation, or I can turn it into psychological, man needs a game plan, man needs a meaning in life, the more Viktor Frankl direction, and therefore Revelation is our meaning in life direction. He says the angels were not mediators at Har Sinai. Chapter 19. How do you know it's true? Okay? How do you know it's true? This is the reason why God revealed himself to all Israel and spoke to them face to face, in order that Moses' mission should be absolutely verified. Therefore God said to Moses, "Lo, I have come unto thee in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with thee, and they also believe thee forever." The meaning is, God said to Moses that he desired to reveal himself to him face to face, that the people may hear when I speak and obey all his commandments, even if they oppose the original Noahide laws, because they will forever know that Moses was the messenger of God. So everyone has this illuminated experience, this God coming to them, because to show you that everybody has it and it's real and it's self-validating, and therefore B'nai Yisrael would listen to it.
You're saying now in our minds, and his aid will get spiritual.
Well, he's saying therefore you won't listen to a false prophet because you heard face to face. Chapter 22 is probably the question you're pushing me toward. What about today? Meaning, are we still having at least several people per classroom getting direct inspiration so we know it's real? Chapter 22 in the beginning. The Torah which we have today, and which has been handed down to us by unbroken tradition from father to son, is the same that was given to Moses on Sinai without any change. Okay? It was not changed in Bayit Rishon, even though they worshipped idols. It was not changed in Bayit Sheni. He analyzes in chapter 22 all the discussions about when Yoshia found the scroll. Does that mean it was a new scroll, a new book? What went on? He discusses those points and says, no, they certainly knew about it. In many ways, Albo, he knows the Islamic, he knows enough biblical criticism of the medieval form to know people said that Yoshia had a new Torah, which is the same thing the biblical critics will say in the 19th and 20th century. Albo gives the same answer that Yechezkel Kaufman gave in saying that no, because everything in it presupposes you know Vayikra, you know the basic laws, that anything new only makes sense provided you have that huge rubric to start with, that whatever they were telling them to do only made sense on the prior background that they knew in great detail from what was. He gives a very similar sort of answer, but he's not putting it in modern terms, he's putting it in his terms. Don't think like the, let's say, the Muslims, that there were new scrolls and we messed up Revelation. and therefore the Quran got it right. He's, you know, he's still saying that no, it's still assumed there was a continuity of content. Nor did it change when they went into exile to Babylon. Nor did Ezra make a mistake. But here at the end of 22, he reminds you, but yes, they did change the writing, and they changed the names of the month, and there was Malay and Chas, there were Malay and Chasers, and there are things that the Sofrim had to work very hard to be, keep track of, and we know there's Tikkun Sofrim. We know there are dots on the words, but this, it doesn't count as an addition or a subtraction. These are all side points, minor points. It is not like someone just got up there and said, you are going to eat matzah on Pesach, you know, 1,000 years after Har Sinai. The fact that there is changes in Kriyat Ksiv or the shape of the otiyot is not the same as the content changing. Okay? There's a lot of food for thought, a lot of distinctions and hakiras that he gives here about both being open to what's there and to and at the same time defending that there's a real common core here that doesn't ever change. Chapter 20, hold on, did I just read it? No. Chapter 23, there's no additions and subtractions, therefore it's perfect. Even the meanings don't change. He shows you why he thinks in chapter 23 the Christian interpretations are not correct. And then finally, chapter 26. Put a marker in here somewhere. So what was given in Revelation? He said this was the instruction manual. This was the content about how to lead a good life. By chapter 26, he comes back and explains it. And I quote from the beginning of the chapter. Insomuch as the divine law is a rule and guide for the human race emanating from God, it necessarily points to a bond and union between God and man. God, the author of the commandments, and man, the subject of them. Hence, it is clear from this aspect that hearing a command from God necessarily proves that there is such a thing as prophetic inspiration, divine revelation, and that there is a God who is the author of the law and exercises providence. It's especially true of those who heard the first two commandments. Okay? What was ultimately the law? Besides just giving guidance, it creates a kesher between Bnei Yisrael and God. Thank you. Uben Adam. It creates a... Thank you, I'm already lapsing into our incredible parochialism of the modern era. But at least in the nice free Middle Ages, it creates a bond between Ben Adam and God, between humanity and the divine, because humanity is still following the mitzvot of Adam, Noah, and the other figures. There is a universal available. Hence you can talk about the Gentiles not just having a God, but having revelation also. Not Nevuat Moshe, but at least Nevuat Noah, Adam and Noah. And I continue. Nevertheless, God desired to let Israel hear from his mouth the Ten Commandments, so that he would know it both from duty and from command. So when it comes to the Ten Commandments, he only uses Yisrael and not Ben Adam.
What's the difference between duty and command? What do you take
from that? Duty could be even a theoretical one from reason. And then he talks about the Aseret HaDibrot. The first five are Ben Adam LeMakom. The second five are Ben Adam LeChaverot. A lot of your very standard, you know, Sidur commentary on these things, or, you know, second grade comments on these, are the rest of the Albo in this chapter, in which he then shows you that God wanted us Bein Adam LeMakom and Bein Adam LeChavero. So unlike the Maimonidean perfection into prophecy, and unlike the Nachmanidean esotericism, we now have the Torah taught us how to live in our relationship to both the divine and to other humans. Okay? You've heard all this before, you just never had a footnote for it.
Well, it's not a video, huh? Of course.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's all. You know, that's the current. Okay. Finally, chapters 28, 29, 30, 31. Mitzvot are good for us. They lead to our perfection. And then chapter by chapter, mitzvot lead to ahavat Hashem. Mitzvot lead to yirat Hashem. Mitzvot lead to ta'anud with God. Going through all the religious benefits of keeping the system. Okay. Questions on Albo? I know I did it in short form. I guess I just don't have an Albo in the Shema here to do it in long form, but any basic questions on this position? Yes.
How much detail does he get about the goal of the law being ethical perfection in terms of exactly what virtue is, and is it very specific virtues that are being developed by specific mitzvot, or is it a general sense about Hashem and Hashem?
It is he's going to single out the Aseret HaDibrot and tell you what you learn from each one.
Since that is what we got directly?
Yeah. He will also single out another very famous section, Malchiyot Zichron and Shofar, the universals, God's kingship, meaning Ben Adam LeMakom, Zichrono, Ben Adam LeChavero, and the ethical parts, and then the Shofar is now the Matan Torah and Yimot HaMashiach, the specific Am Yisrael elements. You know, there are points that he's going to go into, but he's not going to give you how this cultivates this as much as it's back to Ben Adam LeMakom, Ben Adam LeChavero, and the raw importance of Klal Yisrael, of being both Ben Adam and Klal Yisrael. Okay, final one is Maharal. This is from, you've heard this, some of you have heard this before, chapter 16 and 17 in Ferek Yisrael.
Which was
the one dealing with Torah. Maharal's approach to revelation is to prove the necessity of revelation. It is incredibly not historic. It is incredibly not about the encounter. It is very much about the very nature of humanity. And the first one, he says it clearly. And now there are some pre-starting points here. he assumes that about philosophy. Many people don't know philosophy. And second, many of us are brought down by our human bodies not to be contemplatives. Maharal reiterates his view on creation very briefly. The world had to have a design. It's not accidental. Therefore, there had to be a creator, and even philosophers will buy into this teleological argument that there had to be a creator. But his proof for revelation, which I'm going to give you in six steps, is a moral argument, the sort of things favored by either dialectic theologians or conservative small c theologians about the need for moral order. Step one, we all know killing, violence, theft is wrong. Point two, the philosophers think they know these things are forbidden because of the intellect. Step three, but knowledge is contingent, it's not necessary. Meaning, not everybody has not philosophic knowledge to be able to prove that killing is wrong or stealing is wrong. Some people are mentally challenged. And beyond that, some people who once had intellect, when they become old, will lose their intellect. So knowledge can't be intrinsic to knowledge. D. Therefore, they must have a revelation telling you what's true, what's false. Okay? It's an incredibly interesting social critic type of argument. Not focusing on Har Sinai at all, focusing on the moral argument. That's why I gave a point to include it, because there's incredible food for thought and for future centuries within that sort of line of thinking, but he's not done. E. Maybe knowledge of morals is universal, even without the intellect. No, that can't be, because Plato believed we hold wives in common and was against the idea of one man, one woman marriages.
Why can't that be?
Because Plato clearly held that we share wives, which is not the Torah's viewpoint, so it's not a universal ethical position. Ethics are not universal. So therefore we know it through revelation. And then finally, if you don't do what's ethically required, you violate the Seder HaOlam to reality.
Where does Seder HaOlam come from in the first five premises?
It becomes part of this teleology, the order of the universe. It's a moral order and not just a scientific. That's proof number one. Proof number two. We'll evaluate Albo and Maharal afterwards. Proof number two. Everything in the world is complete and doesn't have a lack. Step two. Mankind is filled with lacks, and all intellectual knowledge is an acquisition from a prior lack. Meaning very few of you were born knowing calculus and knowing how to write a good essay in the crib. All knowledge comes from a prior lack. C. Torah, on the other hand, And that's why I gave a calculus example. Torah is complete shleimut. It's always perfect. It's not about acquisitions or gaining knowledge. Torah is completely perfect. D. Therefore, the Torah is for Klal Yisrael, not for individual people. E. Therefore, Torah was given in the Midbar, away from all human habitation, to show you that the Torah is not dependent on human perfection and human knowledge. F. Okay, ready for it? Torah was offered to all nations who could have accepted it if they had wanted it.
Was offered
and could have been accepted. It was not against their nature, meaning the moral order and the perfect Torah was universal and offered to all nations. So once again, unlike what we teach in our more sectarian first and second grades, he's still allowing a much more open possibility. They didn't accept it. Final step, that's why we say Birchat HaTorah and we don't say Bracha for Chachma when we study calculus. Why? Why are there three Bracha for Talmud Torah? The Bracha for Mitzvah Talmud Torah is the importance for us to do the mitzvot, meaning to follow the moral order. Melamed Torah. Why does it say God teaches His Torah? Because God shares His Shleimut. It's not our acquisition. It's not our Kedushei Torah. It's not our understanding of the Torah. But God sharing His Shleimut with us. Final bracha, Bachar B'Amo Yisrael. Is to show you or to teach you the importance of revelation that all Klal Yisrael is included as part of Har Sinai. The Torah is for Yisrael, for Har Sinai, for that there should be a people that will maintain the moral order within the universe. Okay. Third proof why there has to be revelation. Yes? Because if it's individual, then it would be perfection. It's how much you know. Because none of you were born knowing Bava Kamma. Not only did you not know calculus, you also didn't know Bava Kamma either. So if we're clocking what you've learned, then it would also be a perfection. But if we're locating Torah outside of the human realm, then it's for the collective of Klal Yisrael, and Klal Yisrael maintains the knowledge of Bava Kamma.
That's what it does.
It does, even if you only acquired it later in life. Yes?
The comments on the Gemara need the whole thing.
Yes. Yes.
So what's
he saying? He says that originally we knew everything before we were born. We were in our starting place of our Tzelem Elohim, of being one with the primordial Torah. And we then born into this world of Chisaron. And our goal is not to achieve perfection, because that would be chol, that would be secular studies. Our goal in life is not to have chidushim or perfection. Our goal is to completely follow the Seder HaOlam, follow the Nivdal realm of Torah, to be part of the Torah order, in which we then become part of this, the huge Torah Hashem Tanima. But it's not through individual acquisition of knowledge, but becoming part of a bigger order. So our goal is to get back to the womb rather than to make something of ourselves. Third argument. This is the longest one. The starting premise. Man is the head of all earth, meaning man is the crown of creation, and the world is created for mankind. Premise two. Man needs to be mesudar under God, to be ordered under the divine. If not, he would be separate. Meaning we can't make our own moral order. We have to follow the divine. We're in the middle of the Maharal, which you've heard. You're just getting notes for Alba. Three. Therefore, if we want to be mesudar with God, man has to be a mekabel and receive the divine decrees from God, and that's Torah min hashamayim. This is where Heschel picks it up, in which Torah min hashamayim is this divine moral order, rather than pointing to any specific historic event. Point four, man uses his free choice in order to follow God's Seder that is given to him as a decree.
What does that mean?
Man uses his free choice to follow the divine. Next point. Six. Man is not under God only because God is in charge of life and death and is so much greater than us and could zap us and kill us in an instant. The word zap is not in the Maharal. It is not because he could kill us or because he's more powerful than us. No, our very order and being is only because of the divine order. Our very existence is only because of divine order. Meaning, if humans had their own human existence, and this is a longer tangent still explaining that premise, if humans had their own existence, like for example you followed existentialism and we were masters of our own destiny, we have to take courage and follow our own decision-making process. We have to follow good faith and choose our own path and accept it. Then we would be just like the animals. Because then nothing would be necessary, nothing would be intrinsic, nothing would have any bigger game plan. And therefore, like for example, in Camus' Stranger, your choice to drink latte or to kill the person on the beach are equally your own human choices. There's nothing intrinsic to either of them. Or, in the more, if you are following God only because of some Kierkegaardian leap of faith, and it's only your own subjective call, then it's no different than your cat deciding to play in the front yard or in the backyard. There is no intrinsic quality to it. Maharal assumes that we are following the Seder of the Divine because it is intrinsic. Next premise, our connection to God is our sikhli attachment, our mental attachment to God. And therefore, final point, therefore we need Torah min hashamayim for our seichel to grasp, to teach us about our order to follow within this world. and then skipping over some other discussions. Therefore, Torah is Naseh v'Nishma. We accept it as divine decree, as a Makabel, because we don't create our own existential destiny. We learn to choose, to freely choose God as our existential destiny. We need to accept Torah Min HaShemayim and the Divine Word as a necessity. If it wasn't a necessity, then it would only be a human choice, like your choice of coffee. Now, while Rav Isaac Breuer is not dependent on Maharal, there clearly are echoes here of that same approach. That why must he take Torah is because a Yid must, whether you like it or not. Less historic and much more about our very destiny. Okay? Questions on that? None. What? Okay, so we're going to do these one at a time. Let's now look back. Let's start with the latter one first, Maharal. What is the usefulness of Maharal's position? You're shaking your head going, I don't know, I'm going to get all even shy. What?
I don't know. Arguments like this. I don't know how useful arguments like this.
Shows you the meaning of it.
So they ask for it. Wait, one at a time. What?
Now, it doesn't prove it to the fact that it happens. It proves to you that you need it.
You need it, right? Yes.
It's very much stronger.
Yes. Same thing. Okay, let's go through our criteria.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense unless you really buy into the way you see it working.
Right.
So go for it. He's going to say, buy into it. That's your destiny.
You're requiring a person to buy into a new set of reasoning, then you're not presenting them something which is explaining the world to them the way that they live. I mean, you're not dealing with what they have and then trying to explain it using something like that. You're saying, accept this strange thing which you
could
not.
Okay, so let's go get two sides to show you a German question. What is the usefulness for an outsider, a Baal Tshuva, a non-religious, a Christian, or just convincing someone who's not part of this? Is it strong or not? You're going to say it's not strong.
It highlights essential points that you're trying to solve by having that type of tradition, but it's only if you're looking for that, to solve that problem,
he's
exactly addressing.
Okay.
Is that a universal problem?
Yeah. Anyone think it's strong for reaching out to the outsider? Yes.
I think it's pretty strong. Shows you that
it's
part of our being, that we are.
Yeah.
You know, you choose it, but if you
really
want to be
truly
who you are, then you
need. Yeah, this is very much the neo-orthodox argument of the 1950s. You know, you need that divine in God we trust. As many conservative thinkers today still, you know, will argue for there has to be a divine more. You know, how do you solve stem cell research? It can't be through objective panels. It's got to be through a moral argument up above, and that's the way there has to be a revelation giving us that. Yes.
That says one meaning means that we really should have revelation, but that doesn't mean we have it. You're saying something really needed isn't something that's really needed, and then you could just be left saying, yes, we really need it, but who says we have it?
Well, the answer is then you have to have the big premise that Maharal already has, that the world is created for man. Man is the crown of creation. There's purpose in the world. How do you find out the purpose? The answer is there has to be a revelation for it.
Did you ever buy it? Computer without a manual?
Okay. Now don't give me the Kira versions of it. Give me more the argument like Leon Cass had a book on Genesis, that there had to have been a basic humanity moral relationship as the very nature of our human existence.
But that's not what Maharal is going for. It seems that everything he's saying is not natural evolution, that it has to be a completely outside evolution. But if you make the argument that there has to be some sort of human relationship with the divine, that is this revelation because it just needs to be that way. that would seem to lend itself more to natural selection. And I don't think it would cause anyone to buy into Torah Mishmaim.
Well, because the point is here, Torah Mina Shemayim is identified with that natural revelation.
Is it?
Yeah, because it's not the natural philosophers, it's a natural revelation. It's a Seder Ha'olam. It's a natural law type of revelation.
Okay.
Very similar to what a lot of the Catholics invoke now. There's a natural law of the universe that everyone should be able to grasp, that we need such a revelation.
But there's like really no human element. The whole idea that everything is just God, Shemesh, Shemuth, and you don't achieve anything, you don't achieve anything.
Right.
It just makes it hard to picture how natural revelation would work. Like,
because it's not about Kedushei Torah and the books. It's the sort of arguments you hear around today. Therefore, marriage should be limited to a heterosexual couple, meaning there is a, and we're basing that on revelation, not because we're doing parshanot on a given verse in Vayikra, but there's a natural revelatory approach.
On some sort of intuition from the beginning.
You're answering as a
philosopher.
As a philosopher, you can unpack this and say that the location of this, it still implies a great deal of intuitive sense, or identifying this intuition with a given text or tradition or community. And in this case, he identifies it with Torah, the Catholics identify it with the Catholic moral teaching, but it's not about exegesis. Yes?
I think the problem with this is that you start with these premises and you end with a lot of conclusions that are not true. I mean, if you're going to take these, if you're going to assume...
You can come in next class and show, give me the...
Yeah, you start off to say, okay, it has to be that we, meaning the Seder Olam is done, it has to be that we're given this divine thing, because otherwise how will we do anything? Because there's just, you say, man is this point crown of creation, and there's the Seder Olam, so it must be that the world functions in a just way.
Right.
And we say, oh, but it doesn't. So you just turn around and say, oh, we must be the divine model. Who says we do?
So you're saying that you can put in lots of premises.
Not all, it doesn't
okay.
Work.
How about its accuracy to Bible and Talmud? Any thoughts on this one?
Doesn't
good. You don't think it goes there. I don't know. It depends what you do when you do Gemara. Are some of you learning the moral order and the wisdom of the Talmud?
There is
exegesis, but the point is, you know, you're learning through Chumash to know God's will.
So you're doing it in a way where you're saying, I'm not doing anything as an individual, I'm only partaking of God's Shemuth.
Right, which is known for the community.
Right, so you're not accepting an actual outside force, which is what a text is, but you're not accepting yourself either.
Okay.
I don't like it philosophically for that reason. As far as the folks that are, I mean, it's not inaccurate, you can make a read.
Okay. Oh, yes?
Well, like Chazal says, you have to learn this stuff, and if you don't know it, you can't be a chassid.
Right.
So they're treating it like the philosophers.
Okay. So it's picking out those agadatas, yes?
Is this neo-scholastic in that way?
It could be formulated that way. It could certainly be formulated that way. Yeah, it could certainly be formulated. It certainly would very easily be formulated as one. Okay, any other thoughts, pro or con? How about Albo? Anyone have any thoughts about Albo's position? Is that true to the Bible in Chazal? Yeah, that one's... I mean, getting past the fact that that was the one you went to learn in second grade, and probably then again in everything up to 12th grade and onward, is it true? I mean, to the Bible and Talmud? Is it useful? Is Alvo's position useful?
It's useful.
You find why?
More information, that's just good stuff.
Because it's what?
Because you don't have, it's not about perfection anymore now.
It's not about practical life. Okay, so Alba, it's good for practical life.
Being a vegan on my practical life is
keeping the mitzvah, Torah Shabbat, Ben Adam HaVechaver, Ben Adam HaMakom. You've been told that since first grade. If you had a question, you should ask by now. Now is not the point. Now is not the point.
When you say that it's a matter of the perfection to keep the Torah,
yeah.
So all you're doing is you're taking the word ethics and you're defining it as mitzvot, and then you're saying go do the mitzvot. But you're not actually knowledgeable on how to fill in the content of their lives. There's a lot more in life that's not as sort of ethic. So if you're going to say it's about ethical perfection, you can expand on that and make it something more, some sort of virtual development. Make something happen that's going to be new. This really is just what you got in first and second grade, but the idea is that the first grader is not going to ask the question, and someone should tell him something new later. Who should give him something?
Okay, so the answer, he will develop, and he will give you a very, you know, practical, ethical theory here. We just didn't focus on that. Any other thoughts on the usefulness of Alba? Is create strong and right?
For
because okay, so philosophies that don't stretch philosophy are good for non-philosophers. So that works for both Alba and Maharal, which is why I juxtapose them, because they are both in non-philosophic positions. Why did revelation happen? It's either we needed it to know what to live, or there had to be a moral order for reality. They're both moral arguments.
It is so philosophical for the Maharal that he's proving it. I mean, he has this whole, if he feels that he needs to make recourse to proofs, so he's being philosophical in an anti-philosophical way, but
yes,
he's still bringing it up.
Yes.
I think Alba's not doing that as much. He's really just saying, no, we're not going to do philosophy because
well, he is doing theology. He's not doing philosophy. He's presenting the opinions. In this case, he says the Maimonidean position is no good. The Nachmanidean position he sweeps under the rug and basically goes forward with a much, you know, much more basic. It's got to be an illumination. Quoting Crestus, quoting Iran, quoting others.
That's what I do like about him. Is that he's not going to try to have it both ways. He's going to, he is doing theology. He is saying, I'm going to try to put together a set of ideas that's going to work in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to try to prove that it's more correct than anything else, but it is more useful. That's what he needs to do.
And also, it's not as religious as the Rambam or the Rabban. You know, you can be wrong with some other heretic. And reduces down the increments just a few basic ones.
Okay.
I wonder if it's good that he's not knowing Israel.
No,
might not be a good thing.
Because
it might have to be good for the Amalek.
It lets in all, and certainly for the Zohar it would be a problem. Because it lets in all those people who shouldn't be saying.
Right.
No, he still says that they're wrong, just that they're not totally rejected.
That's right. Okay. For next class.